Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 41 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sabalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. It's cold and flu season, as you might be able to tell from my voice, which means it's the perfect time to talk about illness in the medieval world. What happened when someone got sick? Medieval medicine and treatment may be two of the most misunderstood aspects of the whole era, so let's take a closer look at how medicine worked in the Middle Ages. This week, I spoke to Dr. Winston Black, a scholar of medieval medicine and science and the author of several books, including Anglicanus Ordus, a verse herbal of the 12th century, and The Middle Ages, Facts and Fictions. His newest book, Medicine and Healing in the Pre-Modern West, A History in Documents, is a collection of sources from the ancient and medieval worlds, which trace this important history over the course of a few thousand years. Winston and I talked about the foundations of medieval medicine, the different options patients had when they got sick, and a favorite of both his and mine, some of the most pervasive myths about medicine and the Middle Ages. Thanks, Winston, for joining me to talk about medicine and healing in the pre-modern West, which is your new book. So it's great to have you on the podcast, first of all.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, this is a source book, which means that you've picked a lot of primary text to build it up. And that's a tough thing to do, picking primary sources. So for this one, what were you looking for when you were trying to do a survey of medicine and healing in the pre-modern West?
Yeah, that's definitely true that it's difficult to identify the sources, especially when I've got a limited framework. I don't want it to be too long. I want it to be accessible to students. And there are potentially thousands of sources I could have chosen. But I wanted to, of course, tell a story, show a story arc through pre-modern history, the ancient and the medieval world, to show that medicine wasn't just one thing in the past. It wasn't just wrong. it wasn't simply backwards, and it was at times, but that there were significant changes depending on the culture, the geography, the language, the religion. And in a way, one of the things that was really guiding me was to try to fit the documents I chose with the standard shape of a lot of courses in the history of Europe or Eurasia or Western civilization, whatever the topic may be. So I let that guide me in the choice of sources.
So we are mostly interested in the Middle Ages, but in this book, you start with the ancient world. Why is it important to start with the ancient world, even if you're looking at medieval medicine?
Sure. Yeah. As a medievalist myself, I often had to fight the urge to overwhelm the book with medieval sources. But in order to understand medieval medicine, you have to absolutely understand one person and one idea, and that's Hippocrates and humoral medicine. And since Hippocrates was living in 5th century BC Greece, felt it was necessary to put him in his context, show that he didn't necessarily come out of nowhere, that his ideas also developed. So it was really part of this package of pre-modern medicine that, despite the variety I show over time, over, say, 3,000 years, over so much of the pre-modern West, Hippocrates is at the heart of how a lot of people understood their bodies and healing.
Right. So you're talking about Hippocrates and humoral theory. Tell us a little bit about what that means, because I think people have kind of a vague idea of what that means and often get it wrong. So set us straight. Sure. What's humoral theory?
Okay, so it is, yeah, first and foremost, it's a theory as in the way we use a scientific theory to this day, like the theory of gravity. It's always, I think it's important for my history of science students, always to remind them, when we talk about a theory in science, it's not just theoretical. This is how they viewed the universe. So, idea is, our bodies are made up of four kinds of goo, and humor is the humors that comes from the Latin word, but I think the Greek word kumoi that Hippocrates uses better essentially means liquids or sloshy goos. I'll use that. This is my technical term. So they're looking at the inside of the human body and also what comes out of the body. And it probably wasn't Hippocrates who invented this concept, but he was the one who formulated it in teaching and writing. They saw blood, they saw phlegm, boogers and snot and pus. And they then it gets a little harder. They're looking at maybe what you threw up or what they would see inside the body of an animal in the stomach. And they would call this bile. And in some of the earliest sources, they would leave it at that, only three. But the ancient world and the medieval world loves four. You find four everywhere. And so four qualities of Aristotle, four evangelists, four seasons, etc. So they added, they divided bile into yellow bile, essentially what's at the heart of vomit, and black bile, which is harder to define. But they would see if you identify a black substance in a person that's very sick, they said, ah, that's the real bad stuff. So what Hippocrates and his students started formulating is a system where medicine is the practice of bringing those humors into balance or removing humors that have been corrupted or spoiled, promoting the growth of good humors. So much of their explanation and treatment of disease revolved around this system of four humors. And that's what would be inherited by medieval Christians, Muslims, and Jews, and would persist all the way into the modern period, the 18th and 19th centuries. You still find doctors practicing humoral medicine.
So what happens if you show up to your doctor and your humors are out of balance? What would they do for you to put them back into balance?
Okay, so a lot of ancient and medieval medicine might seem surprisingly modern to people, not the actual treatments, but the way they looked at the patient, what we would now call holistic. They would try to understand the patient in their environment, their diet, their emotions, and they ideally would grab all of these questions together and decide, and also looking at their bodies themselves and say, okay, I think you have an excess of phlegm. Pretty easy. You got a runny nose and you're stuffed up. So in order to balance that, what Hippocrates and especially his later students and followers would do is they'd borrow some of the ideas that said from Aristotle. Aristotle and the natural philosophers had argued that the universe is made up of earth, air, fire, and water. You got your four there equal to the four humors, and that the humors and the elements all have qualities. Trying to remember them now. Phlegm is cold and wet, just like water is. And so they would, a good doctor would try to figure out a new diet or a medicine or a treatment that would either remove the cold and wet or would promote the hot and dry to balance that out. So very often, one of the most popular remedies, especially in the Middle Ages, Hippocrates didn't use this too much, but would be bloodletting. It was sort of a cure-all. They would usually, you could bloodlet anywhere theoretically, but almost always it would be the vein in the crook of your elbow, the basilic vein, they would call it. And the idea is if you let out about a pint of blood, it will take with it not just blood, but some of those bad humors. More drastic remedies could be using a burning iron or a hot cup to raise blisters on a part of the body. And they look at a blister forms, it's full of pus. We know it's pus and that's different from phlegm. But what they saw was the humor phlegm is being removed from the body and that they're doing a good thing. More, I guess, more less drastic, I should say, remedy could be also providing a new diet. Cut out wine, drink more wine, eat more fish, whatever it may be. And that would also then balance their humors. So they'd observe the patient for a few days. If they got better, they could say, hey, I did it.
I think that's important that you mentioned. One of the things that you mentioned was they do look at the patient's diet and their sexual health and all these things as well as their emotional health. And I think that's important because when it comes to humoral theory, there are people that have certain humors just as their temperament. And even men and women have different humors as part of their temperament. And that really kind of affected how they would treat people, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You bring up the term temperament. A term that really is introduced in medieval medicine, where they're building on Hippocrates' ideas, and especially, I mentioned before, but the ideas of Galen, a Roman physician who really popularized Hippocrates. They would try to define people, as you said, old and young, men and women, people from different regions, would all be defined by a different temperament, or they especially like the word complexion. And complexion wasn't just the quality of your skin, but it was the whole makeup of your body. So some people are more sanguine. They have more blood in them. Or they are more melancholic, which is melancholia is black bile. And so that will shape their overall health, but will also dictate, doesn't absolutely control, but it can sort of guide their general mood. And so, yeah, that sort of language persisted all the way into the 20th century. We've kind of lost it now. I think some people still use the word sanguine, calm and balanced. Your blood is in good state, phlegmatic. You're really calm, you're chill. But that can mean too much phlegm. So even when the humoral system has been lost, some of the language of the temperaments can persist.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have Hippocrates, we have Galen, super, super influential. And then in your book, as in medieval medicine in general, you have a lot of Arabic sources. So what is the sort of position of the Muslim physicians in the overall look at medicine in pre-modern West?
Yeah, that was especially one of the guiding ideas for my book, where it's called The Pre-Modern West. And what is it? I'm looking at the title here, Medicine and Healing in the Pre-Modern West. A lot of people might just think, oh, that means Europe. And so much medieval medicine, they only look at Europe. But as you hint at, in order to understand medieval medicine, you have to understand the huge role of, I use the term Islamicate physicians. So that does mean Muslims, but also Christians and Jews living in the Islamic world, but right, all of them writing in Arabic for the most part. And with the rise of Islam in the 7th century, Islamic Muslims, and especially people from Arabia, very rapidly conquered a lot of the former Roman Empire in North Africa and the Near East. And in absorbing those lands, they would also actively take over libraries and schools that, especially in the eastern half of the former Roman Empire, contain vast amounts of Greek documents. Greek was the language of the Eastern Roman Empire. And that still included Hippocrates and Galen and many other ancient physicians, natural philosophers. And the Muslims were not hostile to this knowledge. They eagerly absorbed it and also were absorbing some of the knowledge of the Persians when they conquered the Persian Empire and making all the way to India. So what became medieval Islamic, Arabic Islamic knowledge, say by the 9th century, is this amazing hodgepodge of Greek, Roman, Persian, Indian knowledge from the ancient world. And many of these Greek documents, they translated into Arabic. There was a big push, especially in Baghdad in the 8th and 9th centuries, to translate as much of the Greek and Persian knowledge into Arabic, make it available for Arabic readers and speakers. Jump ahead a couple hundred years. Europe, as your listeners will probably know, is pretty behind, yeah. culturally, intellectually behind the Islamic world, but is rapidly catching up in the later 11th, early 12th centuries. And you start getting scholars in Europe. They know these texts are out there. They've got a few short books by Hippocrates that have been translated into Latin earlier, but they want more. And they know they're out there. So it's a paradoxical situation. So many people might know about the Crusades and the violence between Christians and Muslims in the Crusades, but at the exact same time, you have Christians eagerly seeking out Arabic texts, which are Arabic translations of Greek texts, in order to get sort of through the Arabic Muslims back to the ancient past. And you get very quickly, 1090s, early 12th century, dozens of translations of Galen, Hippocrates, their books, but also Arabic, medieval Arabic medical texts are being translated. And so that was one of the issues I really wanted to highlight in my book, showing this eager translation process in several stages, where they're all trying to recover ancient Greek knowledge, but in the process, they're changing it, they're updating it, they're making it fit into their worldview.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like how you said that when the Islamic people started to take over, they weren't hostile to the Greek sources. And I think it's in the same way. The Christians were not hostile to these Islamic Arabic sources because they realized the value of a lot of the wisdom that was in it. For example, we were talking about Avicenna, how this new translation in Irish was found. So Avicenna is one of these people who medieval Christians were totally accepting of his knowledge because they couldn't not, right? So who's Avicenna?
Avicenna, he appears in several documents in my collection. You just can't not talk about him. Avicenna is the Latin version of Ibn Sina. He's a Persian, he's often called a polymath. He's best known for his medicine, but he wrote on almost every topic imaginable in the period from about the year 1000. And his works, but especially his most famous work, known as the Canon of Medicine, the rule, the foundation of medicine, was translated into Latin in the mid-12th century in Spain. And all of the Christian readers knew he was a Muslim, but again, they had no problem with that. What they wanted was his knowledge. He wrote what was far and away the most accessible and complete encyclopedia of medical knowledge, really, that the entire Middle Ages had ever seen. Avicenna was able to do was read dozens and dozens of works by Hippocrates and Galen, but especially Galen, synthesize them, because often they don't work together. Galen would often contradict himself, but he created a coherent, systematic encyclopedia of, we could say, Hippocratic Galenic medical theory and practice. That's important too. So it's not just for teaching in schools, but he would lay down, okay, here's how you make a medicine. Here's how you treat a patient in a surgical case. And so we find across the Islamic and Christian world, really all the way into the 17th, 18th centuries, Avicenna's Canon of Medicine was the book you had to know. Even this is important to emphasize here, even when you say, I study Galen, that will often mean you're actually reading Avicenna. Avicenna's understanding of Galen.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is the book, the Canon of Medicine, that ended up in Ireland and, you know, bound into another book. So
it shows its popularity.
And that's why that discovery was really important. So if we come to Christianity in Europe, a lot of people have this idea that the church really suppressed science, really suppressed medicine during the Middle Ages. So what would you say to that?
Oh, just trying to catch my breath here. This makes me so angry. It is this persistent myth, and it's a myth that really comes out of the Protestant Reformation. 16th, 17th century, you get Protestants who want to condemn Catholicism, and in so doing, they'll try to make the Catholic Church of the Middle Ages look as backward as possible. And what they'll often grab onto is an event much later, of course, the Catholic Church's trial of Galileo. That's not even medieval, but okay, get off topic here. Essentially,
it's worth mentioning, though.
They take this 17th century event and foist it back under the Middle Ages. But yeah, simply put, the medieval Catholic Church did not condemn or suppress any medicine or science. In fact, the church was primarily the main promoter of learning, which included even pagan learning of the Greeks and Romans. All of the universities of the Middle Ages were first and foremost religious institutions promoted by the church, and the church eagerly supported scientific learning. And science meant Aristotle and Galen, pretty much. You get your natural philosophy, your physics from Aristotle, you get your medicine and body from Galen. So, yeah, obviously that was one of the issues I wanted to stress in my book, but at the same time, we need to put a qualifier there. The learning of the ancients is not going to go unchanged when it comes into the hands of medieval Europeans. Most of Europe is Christian by, we'll say, 500 or 600 CE. Eventually, Spain will be lost to the Muslims, but there will still be many Christians living there. So you get Christians trying their best to, literate Christians, I should emphasize here. We really don't know much about what the uneducated Christians were doing in medicine, but literate Christians doing their best to try to fit Hippocrates and Galen's teachings with the teachings of the Bible and the church fathers. And for the most part, it wasn't a problem. They could follow the rules of St. Augustine and the other church fathers as long as a teaching of the ancients doesn't directly contradict Christianity. It's fine. And there's nothing about Hippocrates and Galen's writings that would stand in the way of being a good Christian. Christians could simply see this is how God created our bodies and God gave us the knowledge to cure ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember looking at some stuff about the Black Death at one point, and it was saying, you know, you should pray for help, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't actually help yourself as well.
Exactly. I mean, it's so hard for modern audiences to realize that in the Middle Ages, you could be both religious and scientific. For us, post-Darwin, it's essentially been a conflict, a warfare between religion and science. And this tendency is to, again, project that back in the Middle Ages. But yeah, as you said, any good Christian in the Middle Ages, and especially here in the Black Death, 14th century, it was recommended you pray. You go to church, you do penance for your sins, then you go to the doctor. And you also go find herbs for yourself. You change your diet. All of these were acceptable and overlapping remedies, and it was perfectly fine.
Yeah.
And all of them.
Yes. And in your book, you have some charms. And that's one of the things I really enjoy looking at when I look at medieval medicine, is kind of how these are prayers, but they're also charms. They kind of work in that spot where it's what people might, you know, if they were being insulting, call superstition. But it's kind of a method of getting at healing that is both Christian and has a lot of really pagan roots. So why did you include these charms in here?
Yeah, they come at the end of the book, but I guess they're also at the start. The Egyptian remedies could be called charms as well. Part of it comes out of so much of the history of medicine and science, too, has been what some people might call Whig history after the British political party, or positivist. You only look at the stuff that leads to the present day. You ignore or condemn anything that is backward or superstitious by our standards. And it is exciting to look at medieval remedies that we could say, oh, that worked by the way we understand it. But that does a big disservice to the complexity of the medical systems of the past, which were full of religion and magic and wrong remedies and right remedies. I wanted to show that whole package. And when you look at a later medieval manuscript, which really is almost all of our medieval evidence from the 13th, 14th, and 15th centuries, you'll have a combination of what we might call scientific medicine with a prayer to a saint and a very much non-Christian magical remedy. And so, I'm trying to remind myself here, look at the back of the book here. it's been a while. the medieval Christian healing charms, but I also had a Jewish healing charm. Mm-hmm. What struck me about some of these remedies, is the combination. I mean, I'm looking at here a treatment for a barren woman, a woman who can't have children. The beginning of it is a recipe, which includes wine and herbal ingredients that you cook up in a pot. If you just stop there, you might say, hey, that's just pre-modern herbal medicine. But then you get a reference to God, the one single God, please make this work. But then a magical, they're essentially yelling at a pear tree. I love this recipe where the instruction is you want to yell at a pear tree that the woman is kneeling before. Pear tree, I protest to God and to you, for my fruit has been taken from me. Give me your fruit and take away my infertility. So this idea, you hinted at before, this is pre-Christian, pre-Islamic, probably pre-Jewish as well. In order to gain something magical, you talk to nature. You say, okay, pear tree, you are fruitful. You produce pears, which can look like a pregnant woman. And I want that power. But it's mixed together with the monotheistic religion, mixed together with a herbal remedy that may actually have some efficacy. So it's those, especially at the end of the book, wanted to show the complexity among Muslims, Christians, and Jews. They can draw on all these traditions.
Yeah, I like that. And I like pointing out that fusion, how it works together, because a lot of the things, and we're going to talk about myths in a second, a lot of the things people believe about the Middle Ages is that there's an absolute separation between religion and everything else. Mm-hmm. But one more thing I wanted to ask you about in this book is that at the end of the book as well, you talk about miracle stories. So why was it important to talk about miracles in terms of medicine for this book?
That is a good question. And I thought long and hard, do I want to get that religious where we have something that is, yes, purely a miracle? Every saint of the Middle Ages has healing powers. Some saints were believed to be more specifically focused on healing sickness or helping childbirth, but any saint, just like in the ancient pagan world, any god could potentially heal you. But as I wanted to present this full picture of, well, I say it in the title, medicine and healing in the pre-modern West, I didn't want it just to be the medieval predecessors of our modern medicine. I want some of it to be that, but I wanted to show a medieval sick person or even a physician when they're looking at their options for making a person better, that is going to include the saints. And that's why I especially wanted to bring in some of these documents which show a person going first to a doctor, and then that might fail, and going to a saint, or even a case where a doctor says, I can't do anything, go to saint so-and-so. An acceptance of this multivalent healing tradition. And what I especially wanted, this is really for students of Western history here to get, is that this wasn't a Christian invention. We find this idea, Hippocrates himself, we believe, was trained at a temple, first and foremost, at a temple of Asclepius on his home island of Kos. And Galen, too, probably visited these temples of Asclepius. He's the god of doctors. And at these temples, you could both pray to the god of doctors for healing, but also see a real doctor. So in the pagan world and in the monotheistic medieval world, they're open to both these options. Yeah. And I should stress, it's not just the Christians, but the Muslims have that as well, where they would have both the scientific medicine, but also appeal to Allah and the wisdom of Muhammad the prophet, of what they would call prophetic medicine. And good faith can also heal you in the Islamic tradition.
Yeah, all these things working together.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a great book. And you have another book coming out. We are vibing because you have a book on fact and fiction. I have a book on fact and fiction. You beat me to the punch though. Yours is talking about 10 really pervasive medieval myths. So what was the impetus for you writing this book on these 10 really pervasive myths? And this one is kind of aimed at students as well, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. So both of these books, I hope everyone buys them.
But, yes.
But realistically, yeah, they're written for classrooms. The medicine and healing book, especially for the college classroom, to go along with a overview of Western or Eurasian history. But the other book, it's called The Middle Ages, Facts and Fictions. It's especially aimed at, I would say, upper level high school students as an introduction, possibly, to the idea that what you learned might not be right. And that can be very exciting. I certainly remember this for a voracious reader of 15 years old, suddenly realizing, wow, a book can be wrong. A textbook can be wrong.
Yes.
But that book came out of being a teacher. I mean, I've taught at various universities now for 12 years. And especially I've taught just Western Civ, World Civ, but mostly medieval history classes. And seeing the myths, the misconceptions that students come with, that even when they're told otherwise, it's really hard to shake them free from these ideas. One of the most pervasive, one of the most common, I often will start courses with this, and I know you did this as well for your TED Talk.
That's right.
The medieval flat earth.
Yes.
And entire books have been written about this, but it it's hard to crack that idea that supposedly medieval people thought the earth was flat.
And yeah, I know.
No evidence that they did. And of course, this comes straight out of Aristotle and Ptolemy and all these ancient authors. They fully accepted that the earth was round. And of course, they didn't understand the physics behind it as we do, but and Columbus's voyage was based on not disproving flat earth, but that because he and everyone believed the earth was round. But in that book, as a medical historian, first and foremost, it does lean heavily towards science and medicine. So I have one chapter simply on the myth that we've already touched on that, oh, medieval medicine was nothing but stupidity and superstition. I mean, I'm the first to admit some of it is painfully wrong.
Yes.
But what is often brought up is the example that, oh, medieval people thought disease was caused by elves and goblins. And you do find one manuscript, one old English manuscript that talks about elves. But otherwise, no. They believed that disease was caused by an imbalance of humors in your organs and veins. Maybe not right, but it is scientific and rational and based on observation. The other medical chapter is my real pet peeve, especially as I'm going to promote this year. I've got coming out next year in the same series, the Facts and Fiction series from ABC Clio. I'm writing a book specifically just on the Black Death. The Black Death, Facts and Fictions.
Oh, that's going to be awesome.
the press actually asked for this coming out of the Middle Ages Facts and Fictions because the one chapter I wrote on the Black Death really dealt with two myths. One was the myth of Ring Around the Rosie. Supposedly, that being about the Black Death, it's not. I'm going to go get the book, read it. I'm not going to unpack it entirely. But also, more complicated myth of the plague doctor, the wearing the terrifying long beaked mask. People love it at Halloween or in video games. Again, it's complicated, but essentially it probably did exist briefly in the 17th century, but not during the Black Death of the Middle Ages. So the myths in that book, and I hinted some of them in my medicine and healing book, I want to show that there's sort of a spectrum of myths. Some myths are just completely wrong, and they're based on modern people simply imagining the worst about the Middle Ages. So the flat earth myth or Ring Around the Rosie. But some are more complex. They are based on something that is slightly wrong about the Middle Ages. I'll just give one other example here from the Facts and Fictions book of witchcraft in the Middle Ages. So many people think witches were in the Middle Ages and that they were condemned and burned in the Middle Ages. It began in the 15th century, which one could call the Middle Ages. But for most of the Middle Ages, almost no female witches, none of them were burned. So it's based on taking a later event and pushing it back onto the Middle Ages. Boils down to the idea, if it was bad and superstitious, it must have been medieval.
Yes, absolutely. I think that, oh my gosh, that covers so many things.
Yeah.
If it was bad, it was medieval. And you're right, these things are so pervasive in that, you know, I did talk about the flat earth at the beginning of my TED Talk. I had pictures, you know, pictures. And people still don't believe me. They'll still argue about it because they're so entrenched. So it's good. I like that in your book, you take on 10 and you get at them in depth. And I think that's a great idea. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I was, and especially for students there, the design of the book was to provide them not only with my own discussion of the myth, but also give them some of the primary sources. Show me the receipts, as they now
say. That's exactly it.
It's like, here's the document. Here are pictures and documents from the Middle Ages showing this myth is a myth. Yeah. And yeah. Do the legwork yourself if you don't want to believe me.
Yeah. And I think, you know what? I think our two books, they have really similar titles, but they'll work really well together because mine is kind of an overall survey. It's pretty quick about what people ate and, you know, how they got married and things like that. And I think yours is a really great book to work with it because you're showing the receipts a lot more than I could in the length of book that I have as well.
Well, I hope students or popular audiences can read them together, because I know I've only seen the table of contents from yours, but you were able to deal with a lot more social issues that I, as a historian primarily of science and medicine, I tended to, and philosophy, tended to lean towards more technical issues. But I wanted a chapter on the so many myths about women, just this belief that, oh, women had no power and they were completely oppressed. And it's like, no, that's more true of Victorian England than of the High Middle Ages. And so everybody buy both of our books.
That's right. Yep. They'll work together. They'll work together. Yeah, absolutely. I'm so happy to have you on to talk about your books, because I think that they will go a long way to getting people to have a more clear picture, not just of medicine, but of the Middle Ages in general. So thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's been so much fun talking with you.
Thank you. To find out more about Winston's work, you can follow him on Twitter at Winston E. Black, or find him on academia.edu at independentscholar.academia.edu/WinstonBlack. Medicine and Healing in the Pre-Modern West and his Fact and Fictions book are both available now. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's up, Peter?
Hi, Danielle. Yes, we have another series that kind of started on the website. It's by James Turner, and he's going to be focusing on illegitimate royal children in 12th century England. And this is going to actually, there's quite a lot of them, because it's going to last about a year, this series. And he's starting out with King Henry I, his daughter that rebelled against him, and why Henry was like the absolute world's worst grandfather. So you'll be able to read that on medievalist.net this week.
How often are these coming out, Peter?
Every month.
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right. Get well.
Thanks. If you're following medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists, you probably saw that we've reached nearly 100 patrons on Patreon, and we are so unbelievably grateful for your support. If you haven't been to our Patreon site, check it out. You can find subscriptions to Medieval Warfare magazine, our book club with Boydell and Brewer, and even an ad-free version of medievalist.net for just $3 a month. All the action is at patreon.com/medievalists. As Winston and I discussed, I have my own book out called Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, which makes the perfect complement to his. If you're in the UK, it's already available to you, and other friends from the rest of the world are getting their hands on it through pre-order, or even faster, through the publisher, pen-and-sword.co.uk. Thank you to all the people who have already bought it. I really hope you love it, and you can feel free to tag me and let me know on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Geefrog. Thanks for listening. Here's hoping you're either feeling well or on the way to well. Have an awesome day.